You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
I want to be the title sponsor. What's it going to cost?
I think around 10 million.
Yeah, I that's a bit out of my budget.
I have the impression that we are in the place where we have to be now.
Greg had a really bad back all last week, so we caught up on your podcast with me giving him a back massage and him listening to you guys.
Oh, that's a wonderful image.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Rob Hatch.
Hello, Richard.
Very careful for the order there. I could see Lionel leaning in.
Oh, but look at how happy it's made me. Look how happy it's made me to be promoted back to second place for 1 week only.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's worth it. I don't know if we like you happy, Lionel. It's not your natural state. I suspect you're not going to be happy throughout the podcast, because we're going to be talking today about some things that might not make you that happy.
What, like cycling? No, I'm only joking. Bit of an end of season feel, though, isn't there, at the moment? It's a strange time of year. We haven't quite ended the season, but it's just sort of fizzling out like the world's worst Catherine wheel on fireworks night.
Yeah, you say that, Lionel, you say that, but very quickly we're into the winter, which I quite like, and I think every year we've kind of wondered what we're going to talk about throughout the winter, and every year we've not really had too much problem. We've actually got quite a few things coming up that are going to keep things fresh and exciting.
That's kind of what I mean. The off-season is more entertaining for me than the very beginning or the very end of the season. That's all I'm saying.
Tell what, Daniel Frew's back soon and the indoor cycling's starting. We know he loves that, doesn't he?
He comes into his element in this time of year. The indoor cycling is starting, and we'll talk a little bit later on about the London 6-day and the European track championships as well. Sorry, Rob, were you going to add something to that?
No.
But first of all, Lionel, give us your little weekly roundup.
Well, the Giro d'Italia 2016 route has been announced. We already knew that was starting in the Netherlands. We now know that the remaining 2.5 weeks will be held in Italy.
Wow.
We're hoping to be there, aren't we, Richard, next year?
We are hoping to be there to basically bring you a version of our Tour de France coverage, daily coverage, but we're working on that at the moment, aren't we, Lionel?
We are. Plans are afoot, and whatever the Italian for kilometre zero is, I'm particularly looking forward to making some
kilometre zero.
There we are, Rob Hatch.
That's our jingle done already. So we have a jingle. Now we just have to come up with a show. Fantastic.
Yeah, the European road racing season hasn't quite finished. I think it's Pieter-Capellen in Belgium, or on the Belgian-Dutch border. I think today we're recording on Tuesday, but Paris-Tours is the last big...
Are we still doing a roundup?
Yeah, we are. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. There's only a couple of little items. Paris-Tours, won by Matteo Trentin, the sort of autumn sprinters classic, entertaining edition of the race, and the new race on the calendar, run by the organiser of the Giro d'Italia, RCS, the Abu Dhabi Tour, or the Tour of Abu Dhabi, won by Esteban Chavez of Orica Greenedge. Now, before I finish my weekly roundup, I've got a gift for you both. Hot off the press, a new copy of Volume 6 of the cycling anthology, Richard and Rob. There you go.
Christmas and birthdays come at once.
Christmas and birthday come at once.
This is not a gift, Lionel. This is an opportunity to plug it.
You've seen through the tissue thin veneer there. Yes, yes, it is. But it's a lovely little book, isn't it, Richard?
It looks very nice. I can't wait to get stuck into that. Yes, thank you, Lionel, for that. Bit of product placement early on in the podcast. So Abu Dhabi, you probably saw more of Abu Dhabi than all of us, Rob. You were commentating on it. I caught bits and pieces of it. A new race, end of season race. It was followed by the sort of glitzy, I think, UCI Gala, which was looked like an odd sort of event.
Controversial UCI Gala, I think we should say. There were a lot of people saying that there wasn't much of the women's cycling world represented. There was a lot of people who've flown in and out for it. It sort of happened without too much fanfare in much of the cycling media. But the race before it was...
One second on the gala, yeah. Because I think an end-of-season gala is a good idea, and some sports do it really well. But one, having it in Abu Dhabi, and two... It didn't represent, it was only men's cycling, and it seemed to me that the pin-up boy there was Marcel Kittel, who's had a terrible season. Peter Sagan was there as well. There was apparently no dress code, or if there was, people didn't follow. It looked a bit low rent to me.
Yeah, it looked, from the photos that I saw, reports that came back, people who we were talking to who were there, it was a little disappointed. It looked as though, exactly, what happened. They'd gone over their techno-load of money and had a good night out, which, you know, I'm sure everybody deserves at the end of the season.
We're just bitter they weren't there. We should say that our good friends and colleagues, Laura Messiger and Seb Piquet, friend of the podcast, Seb Piquet, I think Laura's probably a friend of the podcast as well, they were hosting it, and I'm sure they did an excellent job. And I hope, personally, that our end-of-season gala does grow into an annual. I got confused there. Annual institution. I think the sport could do with that, really. But it would be nice to see the whole sport represented.
Yeah, it was just sort of thrown upon everybody at the end of the season. It wasn't something that we've been looking forward to all year, that had been talked about, planned well, that included everybody. Perhaps a venue back in Switzerland where the UCI is, maybe a week after last year's race. Because, of course, think of the people who aren't racing that race. Think of people from women's cycling as well, of course, who had their own programmes. There was no women's Abu Dhabi race to go alongside with the men's at the same time. And a lot of people probably had to fly in, make extra plans, and it probably put a few people off.
Now, there was a lot of support for the Abu Dhabi tour from, obviously, RCS were organising. A lot of riders, a suspicious volume of tweets. Even Mark Cavendish, who wasn't riding, couldn't ride because of injury. A lot of tweets about how much he was looking forward to the Abu Dhabi tour, which I found slightly suspicious. And you wonder about the sums of money involved. There's also a lot at stake because, you know, it was a race where Velon were quite heavily involved on bike cameras and so on. We got some live on bike footage, which was interesting. But as we have come to expect in races in the Middle East, there were absolutely no roadside fans.
Yeah, the climb, we had a few people at the top of the climb, the mountain stage on stage three, which I have to say, kudos and credit to the organisers, that was a really good stage. Just again, perhaps the wrong time of the year. I think a lot of people's gripe with this race is probably the time of the year it comes.
Lionel's sharpening his claws as we speak.
He's getting ready. You can release him in a minute. But yeah, I think it comes at the wrong time of the year, certainly for the temperatures, which is also a bit of a worry and warning for the World Championships next year. 54 degrees Celsius on
the World Championships in Qatar, of course.
Oh, yes, sorry. 54 degrees Celsius on Alejandro Valverde's Garmin before stage two, I think it was. Temperatures didn't vary too much throughout the week. Yes, we had very good racing up the mountain stage. The rest was flat. I'm not a great fan of racing on wide 5-6 lane motorways and through cities.
Or motor racing circuits. The final stage on the motor race circuit, cycle racing on motor racing circuits doesn't work. They're designed for cars. Lionel, get out your kennel.
Well, just a point on the gala. I agree with the points you make there, Rob. I don't know whether it was exclusive in that women, people from the world of women's cycling weren't invited. I did see Lizzie Armistead tweet to say that she was invited but couldn't make it. I just think it's symptomatic or emblematic of the way the UCI tends to do a lot of things. You know, maybe this was a pilot event to see how it would work, but they've got to realise that, you know, if you put on something like this, there will be a public reaction to it. And the public reaction to it was not all that favourable because it looked a bit sort of, you know, half done. And I completely take the point, you know, if you're going to have an end of season gala, tacking it onto the Abu Dhabi tour, which is not a UCI event, it's an RCS event, is an unusual move. Far better to have it, you know, in the homeland of, or move it around. It doesn't matter where it is. It just matters that it's the right and appropriate end of season kind of celebration of everything that's happened in the year. As for the race, I watched some of it on TV. What struck me was how fantastic some of the still photography of the race was. There were some beautiful pictures of the bunch going up in between sand dunes and really striking, dramatic-looking landscape, as long as you take just a snapshot of it. Watched on television over, you know, even half an hour, it's not the most exciting landscape to watch. And that is what, to me anyway, cycle racing is about. It's about the land that the race goes through. And obviously, they haven't got an awful lot to play with. They've got a lot of sand. They've got cities that all look kind of the same. And Rob and Rich, you both make the point, wide roads. We talked about this about the Tour of California, haven't we? Why is it that it doesn't really get the blood pumping? It's because the roads are too wide. The bunch isn't forced to do anything interesting, so it can just ride along in, you know, 8 or 10, 12 abreast. And I think they are fundamental challenges that the race would have to overcome. One last point on the Tour of Abu Dhabi and the riders tweeting, which you made the point, Rich. There's no doubt this is a business transaction. This part of the world has got an awful lot of money and they're trying to find ways to spend it. And top-level sport has proved to be a successful way to invest money. You know, the World Cup's going to Qatar, big golf and tennis tournaments happening in that region. Cycling wants a piece of that action as well. But I caught an interview with Bernie Eccleston on the BBC talking about the possible demise of the Red Bull motor racing team. And he made what I thought was quite a telling comment. He said the reason he likes the Red Bull team is that they will always be up for doing publicity when they're trying to break a new territory. And I thought that really kind of strips back the layers and lays bare what top level sport is about, and cycling's just trying to get in on some of that action.
So they need some contraflows in the desert, some parking cones. Get the parking cones out. A sponsorship opportunity.
Yeah.
Cycling podcast, parking cones.
Maybe we'll let you sort that out. But just one more point on that, a serious point. Sorry to spoil the mood and shoot you down in flames there, but I think it does have a place on the calendar this type of race, and it does. Like, we can't go around the world saying, no, you can't have bike races because it doesn't look as good, you know. It can only be done in Europe, it can only be done here, no. Everybody has to have the chance to have bike races and put them on. But in October, it's a lot hotter than it is in February when the rest of the Middle Eastern races occur. And again, let's not bunch them all together. I've been to Tour of Oman, that's a much more interesting landscape. There are narrower roads, there are natural mountains, there are different things happening. But, you know, Qatar, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, perhaps we should have them January, February, when it is cooler. That is the time of year you can be going there, and it's great preparation for the classics. Good distance.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Yeah, Rob, you mentioned there the other Middle Eastern races, the Tour of Qatar, Tour of Oman in particular. Dubai is a slightly newer event as well, another RCS event. Tour of Qatar, a similar sort of desolate desert landscape. Pretty ugly country, actually, a lot of industry, but cracking racing. The crosswinds and the fact that all the classic specialists go there, and it is now, it's become an accepted sort of preparation for this race for the classics, does actually give it some meaning, and it has sort of cemented its place in the calendar. Tour of Oman, likewise, has a sort of slightly different place with the stage race riders tend to go there. And so these events have sort of slowly establish themselves as meaningful-ish races in the calendar, but an end-of-season desert race doesn't seem to make quite as much sense. So anyway, I want
just on that. Yeah, I've said this before, but this is a great opportunity for a real eye-catching, creative race format, rather than just, you know, four bunch starts held on wide road, one sort of mountainish stage, and the other.
Use the parking cones for an obstacle course one day.
Well, I'm not being necessarily as flippant, but there must be somebody out there. I'm not necessarily saying me, but you know, maybe our listeners have got some ideas. Tweet us at @cycling_podcast for some innovative race formats. You know, whether they could be shorter races, you know, play with some of the track formats on the road. Why not? You've got something that would then go, okay, you know, lots of people would still slag it off, probably me. You know, I say, oh, that didn't work, or this didn't work, or whatever. As you know, Rich, I'm never happy. But if you had a sort of end of season race where there was some genuinely innovative road racing, points races, you know, pursuits.
Devil take the hindmost. Elimination race. Steve Cummings wouldn't like that.
An elimination race. Bunch of 50 riders, and the last five riders over the line every kilometre are out. I don't know.
On the motor racing circuit. Perfect.
Yeah. And then, I think, then you're creating a story rather than just taking what is basically quite a boring thing to watch, unfortunately. And I speak as somebody who will watch almost anything bike related, and turning it into something that people can really get behind and debate and get interested in.
You've written about this before, Lionel, these wacky ideas of yours, and I find them incompatible with you, with the rest of your character. I being sort of conservative with a small c by nature, I think, when it comes to bike racing and the traditionalist, I find it odd that you would be flirting with these ideas that I consider quite wacky, quite out there.
Well, but I think the
dare I say hipsterish.
Well, I think the core of the sport, the classics, the grand tours, even the sort of the shorter stage races, they're not broken. They need to retain the history and tradition. But if you're going to create new events, create new events. That's surely the remit of the UCI and the race organisers. And, you know, RCS has had a few goes at trying to crack into the Middle East over the past few years. And I don't think that the Abu Dhabi Tour, money aside, I don't think this is the answer at all.
Dick Dastas has just sent you a text, I think.
Hey, listen, I want to speak about Tom Bonin. Tom Bonin, who was in cracking form, you know, having had another disappointing year, really. He missed the Tour de France, but he came into great form at the World Championships and has signed a one-year extension to his contract with Etix Quickstep. The World Championships in Qatar next year, is obviously suits him. He's got a great record at the Tour of Qatar. I think his dream scenario was to bow out of the sport at the end of next year with a second world title. That would be the dream scenario. He had a terrible crash in Abu Dhabi. He fractured his skull and is still in Abu Dhabi, and I think he's going to be there for the next couple of weeks, and has been told by doctors that he has to take 6 months off, which would rule him out of his beloved classics.
Yeah, it's a real shame. I've done a lot of talking to people on the ground in Belgium about Tom Bonen over the last 18 months or so. Generally, not just out of a professional point of view, generally because he's an interesting character. He's a great guy to interview. He's one of those professional people you will wish to come across in the sport. A lot of Belgian fans obviously have this deep love for him, and you know they're very proud of what he's achieved. The fact that he's a good character helps as well, like it always does in these sorts of situations. And I think I'd come to the conclusion that this sort of 12 to 18 month period now could have been almost as defining for his career as the early part of his career was, because all these great opportunities seemed to be coming together at once. He was in fantastic form at the start of this classic season, and then look at what happened at the start of Paris-Nice. A very similar crash, the one that's actually seen him injure his skull this time, saw him do his shoulder and put him out of the classics earlier on this year after he'd been in great form in Qatar, Oman, all those sorts of places. He was up there again in big bunch sprints against very fast sprinters for the first time in quite a few years. This year's World Championships, well, he gave it a go, didn't he? I mean, another day that might have come off. Great form, won a race before going to Abu Dhabi. Abu Dhabi, this happens, and if he misses next year, he's only got really the World Championships to cling to after that. Yeah. How does he go about it? How does he build up to it? And then, if that doesn't satisfy him, does he have to go again the year after for the Classics? It could become interminable, and a really, really big decision, I think, has to be made by
it's a real shame. He thinks that he'll be back on his bike in 2 weeks, and riders often don't follow doctor's instructions to the letter. Who knows? He knows his body well. But yeah, that final year next year could be destroyed if that prognosis is correct. And it is a real shame. I've been struck by the number of crashes and the severity of the crashes he and Fabian Cancellara, his other great sort of classics rider of this era, have suffered in the last couple of years. And I mean, this was a freak incident. Tail Boss went down as well. I think it was a bit of metal on the road, so I don't think any blame can be ascribed to anybody. In fact, there was an amusing story which Gregor Brown wrote in Cycling Weekly about Tail Boss being lost. When he came out of hospital, he had to get a taxi back, didn't have any money. A taxi back to the hotel, didn't have any money, and some local woman in Abu Dhabi took pity on him and paid for his painkillers, I think, in the chemist, and then drove him back to the hotel. It made him phone his mum en route to tell her he was okay. Tail Boss is 34, I think. Anyway, Tom Bonen and Fabian Cancellara, I don't think there's any connection between their advancing years and the number and severity of crashes, but it is quite striking, isn't it, just how many times those guys have come down, and come down heavily just the last couple of years.
Well, yeah, and when the big guys hit the deck, you know, they make more of a rumble, don't they? Because we notice, you know, the headline was Tom Boonen has crashed, and when Cancellara goes down, that's the big headline, regardless of who else has come down in perhaps the same crash. But it's been a shame, and we commented on it during the Classics. It was a shame that they were both looking for one last kind of big head-to-head, and we may now not see that at all. That might be it for the Boonen and Cancellara era,
which is a shame. And we did a Friends special podcast on Boonen and Cancellara, of course, just days before they were
immaculate timing, the jinx of the cycling podcast,
just days before they were ruled out of the Classics. But you can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. £5, still three to come. The next one will be a special with David Miller. In fact, we jinxed him last year when we did a special on David Miller's final Tour de France, days before he was also deselected from the tour. So we'll have to be very careful in selecting our targets for next year, I think.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you, British Eurosport, for the continued sponsorship of the Cycling Podcast. And cycling hasn't finished there. Some indoor cycling coming up. At the moment, the European Track Championships, Bradley Wiggins is competing there, among others. And from Monday, British Eurosport will be televising the new London 60, which we'll be talking about a little bit later on. We've got a little interview with Jermaine Burton, who will be riding that. The other big race at the weekend, chaps, was Paris-Tours, the final classic of the year. If it's a classic, a semi-classic, a quarter classic, three-quarter classic, what is it?
Good question.
It's a good race. It's a good race.
It is a great race. It's a beautiful countryside, lovely one to cover or follow, you know. Again, it's a little bit of a victim of the having been left out of the World Tour, so the quality of the field has diminished over the last few years. It used to be the place where all the big sprinters would go, particularly the ones that hadn't had a great year would go with real great motivation, and we've seen some really good finishes over the years, you know, with Philippe Gilbert in the mix, particularly when they added in a few of these little sharp hills on the run into Tour. But it's a lovely race, and it's one which it's a shame really that it's not sort of managed to keep that prestige, and it does show just how much the World Tour has kind of, you know, taken away. You know, it is elevated above the rest of these races, and the only races that are not World Tour races that still, you know, manage to retain a bit of prestige are the ones with an awful lot of money behind them. Whereas Paris Tours is one that you would have to say ASO is preserving and propping up.
To be fair though, it was a pretty high quality group that got away towards the end in the usual sort of frantic finale over these little climbs, narrow lanes. Matteo Trentin was particularly aggressive, the Etics Quickstep rider from Italy. He got away with Greg Van Avermaet from BMC and Tosh van der Sand from Lotto Soudal. A strong group. He's only 24, Van der Sand, a very promising and quite a versatile young rider. Van Avermaet, Trentin, obviously far more established. Van Avermaet, perennial second, although he did win a stage of the Tour de France this year against another perennial second, Peter Sagan. But Van Avermaet seemed to suffer a puncture in the final kilometre. He stuck his hand up at one point. I'm not sure if he expected a wheel change. But he stuck his hand up, then he was bouncing up and down, and he seemed to have a terrible slow puncture, which meant he couldn't contest a sprint, and Trentin took a fairly easy victory.
Yeah, I think anybody who's seen Matteo Trentin racing recently in the last two or three years, after those sorts of hilly sorts of days, he tends to be the quickest anyway. I think I'd have put money on him to beat Van Avermaet towards the end there. Van der Sand, it's good you mention him. He's a rider I'm... I have it on quite good authority that a few teams were interested in taking him for next year. In the end, it looks as though he's going to stay at Lotto, continue his development there, and he's in a good team to do that, surrounded by good people, not too much pressure there like there would be at Quickstep or anywhere else as well. So good to see him up in the end of the race. And yeah, I have to admit, we were, of course, working on Abu Dhabi at the weekend, but in the corner of our eye, we had a little monitor on with Paris Tour following that towards the end, and it looked a really, really very exciting finish from the bits that we managed to see during the ad breaks. And yeah, why isn't it World Tour? Disappointing. It could be a fantastic big finale to the season. Yeah, it's good having Lombardy up there as a monument to finish things off as well, but why not give the sprinters something to look forward to? Because it seems that apart from the Vuelta, there's nothing else towards the end of the year, no?
We call it a sprinter's classic, but is it really a sprinter's race these days? It doesn't, you know, it seems to more favour a puncheur-type rider, you know, Philippe Gilbert, who's won it a few times. John Degenkolb won it in 2013. Going back a bit, Alessandro Petacchi, Eric Zabel won it a few times, but... You know, Mark Cavendish, who has ridden it, has never won. He rode it just after becoming world champion, didn't he, 2011?
Yes, he did. I think there's a famous quote that gets thrown back at him when he said he wanted to win it four times, because Eric Zabel, who at the time was working with the HTC Columbia team, he'd won it three times. I think that is the record. But yeah, they put these little climbs in because the finish in the Avenue de Gramont, I think it was becoming a little bit predictable. Eric Zabel would win, and it would always be a bunch sprint, the riders attacking to try and get away. I think a very famous example was when Richard Virenque went on a crazy long break, and it's one of those races. It's like a transition stage of the Tour de France almost, but a classic. But they've certainly gingered it up in recent years. As to why
2001, Richard Virenque.
It was, yeah, just after he'd come back from his suspension, I think, and quite controversial at the time, because I think it may even have been his first race back, and he went off on a big break 200 odd kilometres on his own and held on at the end. One of those stories where you want to herald the incredible feat, but there's too much backstory to really celebrate it. But Paris-Tours, you know, it's a victim of exactly what you were saying, Rob, about the need to open up cycle racing to the rest of the world. We can't continue to have all the biggest events in a handful of countries.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/SPC to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
Thank you very much to Trainer Road, who throughout the winter will ensure that we are able to keep bringing you these weekly podcasts. They're a US company. They are sponsoring us. It's a bit more than a sponsorship deal, because the three of us, myself, Rob and Lionel, are also signing up to follow one of their training programs. We have now had the date of commencement, October the 19th. Lionel, I think you were in discussions with Trainer Road last week, high-level discussions.
I was trying to get a bit of early intelligence about what is involved. Should just point out, Trainer Road don't actually set the training plans, but there are plans that you can follow. But really, it's like having an electronic motivation device to set you a target, get you training, and we're going to feel like we're letting ourselves down if
with a real coach as well. We should point out Coach Chad is going to be coming on the podcast.
Well, we're having a real coach, aren't we? But the Trainer Road, that's because we're basically clueless dunderbrains and we need a bit of help, and we're going to be shown the ropes, exactly how it works. But I'm assured that it's very easy, and that even a Wally like me will be able to follow it.
He is the coaching brains behind Trainer Road, and so we'll be hearing from him on the podcast as we go through our programs with an end goal in sight, which we'll tell you a bit more about later on. Okay, so we've got a couple more things to talk about, and we've got a little interview with Jermaine Burton, the young British rider who will be riding the revived London 6 Day. When was the last London 6 Day, Lionel? 1980?
35 years ago, so whatever that is. Might well have been 1980, yeah, of course.
Well, whenever it was, the last one was ridden by Jermaine's father, Maurice Burton, who was a very accomplished 6 Day rider in the 70s and early 80s. He rode with Bradley Wiggins' father, Gary Wiggins. Jermaine Burton now rides quite regularly with Bradley Wiggins, so there's lots of connections there. We'll hear from Jermaine in a moment.
Yeah, the London 6 Day, it was for many years sponsored by Skoll, lager company, not a sort of prestige lager these days. I don't know if it even exists. Does it, Skoll Lager? I've not seen it.
Skoll. Remember the advert?
Yeah, but I remember buying a London 6 Day.
Oh, I wonder what you're going to say there.
Buying a
six pack.
Skoll London 6 Day program at a car boot sale in about 1986, 87, and that was my sort of, I had no idea what 6 Day racing was until I bought that program. Still have it today, and so the revival of the London 6 is really quite a big deal. I was too young, hard to believe that I was young once, too young to actually go and watch the London 6 when it was at Wembley, but I know people who went and said, you know, they were really great occasions, and maybe we're seeing the return of a winter tradition here.
Well, I mentioned that I went to see Jermaine Burton, who's based most of the time in Manchester at the British Cycling Academy up there, but was back at his father's bike shop, Devere Cycles, in Streatham, which was a 12-minute bike ride from my house, so it was a nice, easy interview to carry out. I went to speak to Jermaine, who's riding the London 6 Day with his British teammate, Mark Stewart, and here is what he had to say. So, Jermaine, we're in your dad's bike shop here in South London. You're riding the London 6 Day. You've had a little taste of 6 Day riding before, you were telling me, in Bremen. What was that like?
It was actually my first Madison. It was an eye-opener. I was sort of expecting it to be, you know, what I was faced with, but, you know, when you're, like, chucked into the situation, you're on a 166, yeah, it was carnage, if you like, but got into it. We slapped off a couple of times over the course of the weekend, but we ended up, like, sort of finding our feet, and by the last session, we won the last session, and we ended up, like, third overall, I think. So we didn't do too bad, but it was a great atmosphere, obviously, on a 166, you know, a really compact track, and, like, in a big arena, you know, massive crowds there, and it's given me a good little sort of introduction into what the 6 Day scene's like, and I'm looking forward to picking up, yeah, sort of where I left off a couple of years ago.
But Madison Racing is obviously at the heart of 6 Day racing. You know, to watch a Madison race is pretty confusing, having a perspective on it from the outside of the track. Being in a Madison race, how on earth do you keep track of what's going on? I mean, you've got your own, you know, partner to concentrate on and not miss a changeover, but you've got that. But also, do you find that the racing quite, is it quite confusing, or when you're in the middle of it, is it actually, do you know what's going on?
Well, to give you one instance, the last Madison I rode was at the Derby Revolution round in August. Brad and Cav were there riding together. So they were riding in the new GB kit. I was partnered with my housemate, Matt Gibson. We were wearing ODP kit, which is similar to the GB National kit. Cav, he asked someone, you know, if they could change our jerseys because they look so similar. And I think for someone of, you know, a former World Madison champion to ask, you know, they were quite similar, but...
I don't think he'd have mistaken you for Bradley Wiggins, would he? Wiggins might have mistaken you for Mark Cavendish, maybe.
I don't know, but for someone like him to say something like that obviously shows that this concentration, you know, massively is required. And sometimes when you're absolutely on the limit and you look over the track and you're trying to spot your partner out, it can be difficult. And, you know, I know myself a couple of times, even in that race, like once I looked around 20 laps to go and you're like really like swinging. You look again and your partner's like attacked or whatever, and you know, you've sort of been caught out. I have to be fully switched on for the six because no, it's going to be a hard race and you don't want to be caught out there. Yeah, I think there's going to be 18 teams. So if you take like points race, for instance, requires a lot of attention. You know, you've got sprints every 10 laps or whatever, but even in, like in a Madison, you're going to have like 36 riders on the track. Yeah, you really have to be switched on.
Do you enjoy it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it's one of the, probably like the most exciting race I find anyway. And yeah, I like to get stuck into a Madison. You know, I really enjoy it. And you know, yeah, sure, you have to be like, you know, it takes a lot of concentration, but I think you know, it's a really enjoyable discipline on the track. Yeah,
tell me about your dad, obviously famous 6-day racer. Has he spoken to you a lot about the 6 days? You know, is that something that you've grown up having an appreciation of through your dad?
You know, it gets to a point now where like, he would tell me a story and I'd say, yeah, yeah. I've heard that story 10 times before, but no, it's all good. I grew up listening to those stories and it's all very interesting. And you get an insight into, obviously, you know, you hear the names, you hear like about Patrick Surcue, Pynan, and my dad's friend Roman Herman. He's also like told me a lot about the race. And it's hard to think when you put on the spot, but yeah, I mean, it was really big back then. And my dad's, I think, told me like one winter he may have ridden about 17 or so 6 days. Some days he'd like travel from one through the night, start the next night. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of history in it, and nice to see that there's an effort being made to try and revive it, especially, you know, in London. Nice to see, you know, about 30-35 years later it coming back. And no, I'm really, really looking forward to getting stuck in. And, you know, my dad would be there on hand, so if I have any questions, which I'm sure me and Mark will, then I'm sure he'll be happy to give us a bit of advice, yeah.
Okay, we heard there from Jermaine Barton. So we're going to go to the London 6 Day. I think next week's podcast will come from the London 6 Day, Lionel, is that correct?
Yeah, we'll be there, won't we? I'm not sure how many nights you can make it for, but I'll certainly make it along for one night, go and see what it's all about. Yeah,
I don't want to cram your style. You've got form at 6 days, having been to the Ghent 6 Day and recorded an unforgettable podcast there on your own.
Oh, the air quotes around unforgettable were palpable, Richard.
There are no air quotes at all. How can I do air quotes when I'm holding a microphone? Anyway, we'll be there. We'll be podcasting from the London 6 Day. Just before we go, a couple of little bits of transfer or team news. Matt Goss is joining Team One Pro Cycling, which is the very ambitious British team set up at the start of this year by the English cricketer Matt Prior, intending to move up to Pro Conti status in 2016. Matt Goss has 1 year MTN Quebeca, previously on a huge contract at Orica Greenedge, Milan San Remo winner a few years ago. Also, about 2 centimetres away from winning the world title in 2011, the one that Mark Cavendish won. So, you know, this guy was close to being the rainbow jersey wearer for a year. And what's happened to Matt Goss? I mean, lots of rumours, theories, stories, gossip. One story I heard was that he didn't impress MTN Quebec at the Paris-Roubaix recon when they were wrecking the course, and he climbed off during the recon, which is quite unusual, blaming blisters, and I don't think that went down well. It wasn't a sign of huge commitment from him among the sort of team. So he hasn't impressed at MTN Quebeca, and it's a bit of a mystery. The question is, for a team, an ambitious young team like One Pro Cycling, is signing someone like Matt Goss a good move?
It can go one of two ways, can't it? Either people can be inspired by what he's done, the fact that he came from that high road stable of fantastic sprinters, not just Cavendish and Greipel, Sealek as well was there with them, and Goss at the same time, winning Milan-San Remo, he won Giro d'Italia stages back in the day as well. He was a very, very fast man, both in the lead-out and finishing things off himself. But then he just all went downhill, didn't it?
He was a guy that, when Cavendish moved to Team Sky, he was the guy he said he most feared. You know, he was the one who he thought was going to really challenge him over the next couple of years. And it's a fascinating story. And I guess whether it's a success or not at One Pro Cycling just depends entirely on his appetite.
It does, and also it depends entirely on how much it's costing One Pro Cycling. If they're getting him for a, you know, bargain basement salary that's kind of in line with his results in the last two or three years, then it could be a very good gamble. If he's costing them a packet, then, you know, we haven't seen an awful lot of him to suggest that he's suddenly going to switch it on, and it's going to be a real adjustment for somebody who's won Milan-San Remo and raced in the biggest races in the world, taking that kind of step down. I'm not denigrating One Pro Cycling at all, but they're not going to have the biggest of race programmes. And in these smaller races, the pressure and the spotlight will be on Matt Goss much more than it would have been had he stayed at a higher level. You know, he's not going to be able to just get by doing a job for the team. He's going to be expected to get some results. And really, if you look at his career as a kind of a cricket analogy, you know, he's the guy who scored a century against England to win the Ashes, followed by successive, you know, Golden Ducks.
Team owner will, I'm sure, like the cricket analogy, even if he doesn't like the sort of message behind it. Any other team news?
Yeah, some pretty bad news for Team Colombia fans coming out of South America, I'm afraid. Claudio Corti, the man in charge, said that it's very unlikely that the team will exist next year at the same level, which is at professional continental level, or even exist at all. So not great news for Team Colombia fans. We've seen a bit of a resurgence in Colombian cycling. Team Colombia not necessarily obtaining all the results that Colombian cycling has obtained in the last few years, but it's helped that development, helped that process, and unfortunately it looks extremely likely that they won't be around next year.
And Esteban Chavez, who's been a sort of late season revelation, I guess, came through that team as well, didn't he?
He did. He was in the development squad there for a couple of years. He rode with them as a pro for a couple of years as well. Then went to Orica Green Edge. But I think with the progress he's shown since, just shows that if you're in the right place, surrounded by the right people, you have talent, you work at it, you get the results.
A bit like the podcast, Rob. I mean, you know, since you've been replacing Daniel, your level has just gone up and up.
What do I say to that?
Nothing. I think we should wrap it up. Listen, we've got some live events coming up on the 15th of November, Sunday the 15th of November, from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock. We're doing a live event at Lords, the home of cricket. A lot of cricket in this week's episode. We're doing, myself, Daniel and Lionel are taking part in a cycling podcast live event. Come along and be part of the audience there. And then a few days later, I think Friday, November the 20th, we're doing the Ruler Classic at a venue in London. Tickets for that are obtainable through Ruler.
Quite a prestigious race programme for us at the end of the season, isn't it? Lords and then the Ruler Classic. It's, you know, it's we better get rehearsing.
It's all shaping up nicely. And we've got some other events coming up which we'll give you more details of as and when. Don't forget you can buy our t-shirts online. We do, Lionel, yeah. Secret plans. TheCyclingPodcast.com. Where if you have any particular phrases or cult heroes, podcast heroes from the year, send them in and we could perhaps turn them into a t-shirt for just in time for Christmas. We're going to expand our range for Christmas, so any phrases that you'd like to see turned into a t-shirt, let us know at the usual places, at cycling_podcast. We're on Facebook, where we have an email address as well, cyclingpodcast@outlook.com. So that's it for this week. Thank you very much, Rob.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.